The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry this week. Thank you so much for listening. After a year of investigations in Cleveland, there will be no criminal charges against the police officers involved in the shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. That news came from Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Tim McGinty on Monday.
A short time ago, we informed Tamir's mother of the grand jury's decision. We explained to her that this was a difficult decision, but that to charge police, even a situation what was as undeniably tragic as the death of her son, the state must be able to show that the officers acted outside the constitutional boundaries set forth by the Supreme Court of these United States. Simply put, given this perfect storm of human error, mistakes, and miscommunications by all involved that day, the evidence did not indicate criminal conduct by police.
But for the Rice family, the shooting and subsequent investigation was symptomatic of much more than a perfect storm of human error. In a statement released by their lawyers, the Rices accused McGinty of, quote, abusing and manipulating the grand jury process. For more on the case's handling and the reaction from Cleveland, we turn to ML Schultze, WKSU digital editor and reporter. Schultze, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much for having me.
That perfect storm of human error that Tim McGinty, the Cuyahoga County prosecutor, described. How is Cleveland reacting to that characterization of the killing of a 12-year-old boy in a park?
Cleveland, of course, as any city, is a mix of parts. Overall, the public reaction has been actually relatively muted. There was a protest last night, maybe 3 dozen people marching from the place where Tamir Rice was killed over to a police station. Everything kept very peaceful and calm, as have many of the protests that have happened since November 22nd of 2014.
There has been some questioning and criticism of Tim McGinty after he said that he's not bringing charges here, about sort of his justification, saying the grand jury in this case didn't select charges. A lot of people had a problem with that, knowing that prosecutors shape grand juries to indict or not indict. What's the reaction to that?
Well, McGinty did say that he did make a recommendation. He did not see a criminal case here. He saw a tragedy, a human tragedy. And he is very insistent that he went through the review process. He was far more public and transparent about it. And actually, even those who criticize him do acknowledge that. In fact, that's one of the point of criticism, is that he was letting out too much information about the grand jury process, trying to steer public opinion even before the grand jury decided. And the family of Tamir Rice says it's very clear that from the get-go, he did not want an indictment. And in the name of transparency, he was trying to build public opinion that way.
Now, you also heard from the deputy prosecutor, Matt Meyer, on that perfect storm of human error that McGinty described. Listen.
The 911 operator never told the dispatcher about the possibility that Tamir was a juvenile or the gun was a toy, which led to the two responding officers to believe that a real man with a real gun was threatening innocent people's lives at a recreation center.
Now, again, ML Schultze, this goes to the argument of the perfect storm of human error, that when officers arrived in that park where 12-year-old Tamir Rice was playing with a toy gun, they didn't have any expectation that he was a kid or that it was a toy.
Yeah, and actually, this is the one place that original 911 caller is the one person who apparently was not part of this perfect storm. He did everything you would want somebody to do. He called the 911. He said, there's a guy with a gun outside the rec center. There are people around. He's getting them nervous. But 3 different times, he qualified it by saying the gun is probably fake. It's probably not real. He also said it's probably a juvenile. So in every way you would want a responsible citizen to handle that kind of call, he did. It's from that point on that things apparently became that perfect storm, because you have a dispatcher who didn't pass on those 2 key pieces of information. And as McGinty said yesterday, the officers raced in with very little time for anything to go in any different direction because they thought the gun was real.
What about when they got to the location, though, despite the 911 caller, despite the dispatcher, the police have said that they believe that he was much older than he was. He stood at 5'7 and wore 36 size pants, they said, and that they thought that he was an adult, or at least much older than 12.
And the emphasis on the appearance of the boy has become one of the points of criticism of McGinty. It's actually part of a well-documented pattern where when white people see black children, they are often likely to describe them as bigger and scarier than they would describe a white child. And this emphasis on his appearance, there's no question he was large for a 12-year-old, but this emphasis is seen as almost saying, well, that explains it. What other people have raised is, had it been a white child with a gun, regardless of size, would there have been more time for it to have taken a different path?
So in May, the city of Cleveland agreed to a consent decree. That's an agreement to resolve a dispute without admitting guilt with the Department of Justice to change the way officers report and use force. Now, ML Schultze, this case is closed, I guess, from the perspective of Cleveland and Cuyahoga County prosecutors. What's next for the city?
Well, the city immediately had a press conference within 2 hours of the announcement of this decision, saying that disciplinary charges and administrative review will continue. There are questions about whether the whole approach was within departmental policy, and if it was within departmental policy, should that policy be changed? There also is a consent decree that the city is under. The killing of Tamir Rice occurred within days of the Justice Department releasing its investigation that found that overall Cleveland had a systemic problem and needed to do something to clean it up. And it is spending a great amount of money and a great amount of time and redoing its police department use of force, training, recruiting, and community relations to try to make a difference. That appears to be going ahead as everybody, both the Justice Department, the city, and the state would like to see. And meanwhile, the state of Ohio itself has set up a task force, actually two task force, to review police use of force and training and recruiting. It's seen as a tragic situation by everybody all the way around. That's the one place of agreement. Whether it should be criminal or not, that debate will continue as well.
No charges in the killing of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in a park in Cleveland by a police officer, but still failure all around. ML Schultze, WKSU digital editor and reporter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm sad and I'm disheartened all at the same time. I just wanted to see something, some justice done, at least for the family's sake, for the city's sake, so we can get some healing and unity. Now it's going to be this discord, this separation again.
That's activist Laura Cowan reacting last night to the decision not to indict Cleveland police officers for the killing of 12-year-old Tamir Rice outside of a rec center. The decision is a new chapter in a long history of police misconduct and an adversarial relationship with the community in Cleveland. Here was some reaction from the community in Cleveland. Khalid Samad, longtime community organizer and founder of the anti-gang violence group Peace in the Hood. Khalid Samad, welcome.
Glad to be on.
How are the friends and family you've been in close contact with reacting now?
Basically, they're not surprised, but they're disappointed. We talked with about 20 to 25 youth yesterday near the rec center. And, most of the youth feel that there was a breakdown from the very beginning when the first call went in. And talking to the adults who are familiar with the grand jury system, In Cuyahoga County, there's an old joke out that says a grand jury will indict a ant for being an insect. So they know that the power of the grand jury to indict is easy. They do it all the time. But they also said no one that I talked to who was an adult, in particular African-American community, but also in the broader community, thought that there would be an indictment. No one.
No one had any expectation of charges here.
And I haven't talked to one.
And is that because of the facts of the case or because of people's expectations of how prosecutors and grand juries and police operate in Cleveland?
Exactly. The culture of prosecution, prosecutors, the relationships between prosecutors and police, the history of racism, the history of non-prosecution of white police officers for shooting African-Americans. In fact, to this date, I'm not sure, and I may be wrong, but I don't think there's ever been a white officer indicted for shooting a black person in the city of Cleveland once. And if you turn around and look at the instances of black officers shooting black people, you won't find hardly any. So that understanding is pretty consistent throughout the African-American community.
Khalid Samad, our last guest, ML Schultze from WKSU Cleveland, just described the long history, described the investigations, and explained that the Cleveland police are under a consent decree. Where do relations go now between a community and a police department that has this kind of history?
Clearly, this is where organizations like Peace in the Hood and other coalitions, you had Laura Cowan on just a little while ago. She's a part of our organization, and we coalesce with a lot of organizations. We partner and collaborate with the public safety department, city officials, clergy, and street organizations and formations where youth are involved in on the street. This is where the work's going to have to be done now in order to reduce tension and to promote, you know, some type of, you know, understanding in the streets, because if we have another situation like this, we, you know, it's no telling what might happen.
Khalid Samad, founder of Peace in the Hood, longtime community organizer in Cleveland. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
The Cleveland police officer who fatally shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice last year will not face state criminal charges. And you're sharing your thoughts with us on Facebook. Francesca writes, why? If the boy were white and the officer black, then the officer would be facing charges. Celeste writes, Tim McGinty, the white Tamir Rice prosecutor, said that, quote, the victim could have been my own son or grandson. But really? Could he have been? And Dan writes, people on Wall Street have been looting the American people way more than the entire history of black crimes combined. Trillion-dollar scams, market manipulation, predatory lending, fraudulent accounting, insider trading. And guess who goes to jail? Black people. How many bankers and cops have gone to jail? We always want to hear from you. Tweet us at The Takeaway or write to us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to find cures for leukemia, lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, and myeloma, improve the quality of life for patients and their families, and ensure access to treatments for patients. LLS.org. TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
All this week, we're looking at the debate over privacy and security. It's part of a series we're calling Lockup, Encryption and the Law. Yesterday, we heard from Manhattan District Attorney Sirens Vance Jr. and the case for allowing law enforcement to access encrypted devices. Vance's view is one echoed by FBI Director James Comey, among others. But of course, it's just one side of this debate. Julian Sanchez is senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he has a very different perspective here. As Sanchez sees it, weakening encryption would open up technology to holes that could be exploited by criminals or terrorists. He says that contrary to what law enforcement officials say, today's technology does a lot less to impede investigations than it does to help them.
If it were the case that because phones are encrypted now, the police were just completely unable to investigate and prosecute crimes of all sorts, that would be a pretty strong case for thinking very hard about some kind of mandate. But if you look at all the myriad sources of information the police have when they're conducting investigations that they didn't have even 20 or 10 years ago, it's very hard to take seriously the idea that the police are suddenly going dark or going to be rendered unable to do their jobs. All that valuable evidence and data that they're worried about not being able to access locked behind a phone is evidence that, for the most part, they would never have had at all 10 or 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we didn't all carry devices that track us everywhere we go. We didn't have devices that keep these detailed records forever of all the conversations we're having, and certainly that keep those records not just on the device itself, but in the hands of third parties that can be subpoenaed.
Well, Julian Sanchez, let me have you listen to Sirens Vance Jr., the Manhattan district attorney who was on with us just yesterday talking about his argument to have access to this information because it helps him and his colleagues solve crimes.
What I want to do is to have Apple be able to maintain in its own possession a digital key to unlock its own devices. I don't want a key. All I want Apple to do is when a judge has determined by looking at a criminal case that there's a need to get into this device – and issues an order, that order can be effectuated, and the evidence, which, by the way, is evidence that we're trying to put together to deal with the thousands and thousands of state cases all around the country, That's the evidence we're trying to achieve.
Julian Sanchez, there's Cyrus Vance Jr., the DA in New York, arguing that he doesn't want the key to an Apple phone. He knows that it would be inappropriate for him to have the key to an Apple phone. He wants Apple to have the key to the Apple phone and for Apple to use the key when a judge under the Fourth Amendment says to use the key. So what's wrong with that?
That's a less terrible model than the government itself having all the keys. But it does ultimately mean you're deliberately weakening the security of a system. You are inserting into a system that's designed to protect user communication software designed to cause it to work against that person's will. That's inherently a form of vulnerability that creates potential for exploitation by others. So if, for example, there's some kind of master key Apple has, the security of all the devices then becomes dependent on the security of that key. So for an attacker who's thinking about whether to invest resources in breaking the cryptographic protection on a certain kind of device, the question is no longer what's my return on breaking this particular device, but rather the question is what's my return on investing the resources to break the master key that gives me access to all of them. And certainly, if Apple's holding the key for the sake of our government, there's just no way it's only going to be our government that makes use of it. Once you say Apple and Google and other device manufacturers have to hold a key for a U.S. government use, you're implicitly saying they're going to have a key for Saudi Arabian government use, the Russian government's use, the Chinese government's use. And then the question is, are the kinds of petty crimes you're solving more easily, is that worth throwing under the bus everywhere around the world living under repressive regimes that would benefit from having the kind of security and shield against governments that are going to punish them not for things we would consider crimes, but for speech against the regime?
Okay, petty crimes is one thing, but I know you're prepared for the counterexample because you have to be, which is the example that law enforcement uses. It's not a petty crime. It's a terrible murder. It's a multiple murder that took place, and it's not a hard situation really to imagine in a hypothetical, Julian, where the murderer was texting on his iPhone that he's about to do it or bragging to a friend that he did do it, and he was careful in every other way. It's not hard to imagine that real evidence for that crime is on that phone, and Cyrus Vance and James Comey say, we got to be able to look on that phone. It's nuts that we can't. Tell the family of the murdered victims that we can't look on the phone.
Are there going to be genuinely bad crimes where there's going to be evidence that would be useful to the police on that phone? There doubtless will be. There are doubtless going to be cases where it would be easier for the police to not have to bother getting a warrant to get access to evidence. There are going to be cases where protections for civil liberties, protections for the security of innocent people also make things harder for police. And in some cases, that might even mean a case goes unsolved. The question is, do we think that's going to be so many cases the trade-off is worth it? And that's hard to believe.
The FBI has complained, James Comey has complained in public, that the perpetrators of the shooting in Garland, Texas, sent, he said, 109 messages over an encrypted platform on an app that they just can't read. Now, this is different than a key for an iPhone, but now we're talking about backdoors. We're talking about giving law enforcement the ability to get in and monitor terrorists.
So, again, one thing I note here is that very often the problem of encryption, the supposed problem of encryption, is invoked before there's any kind of public evidence that that was actually what interfered with an investigation. I mean, before the blood had dried in Paris, we heard cries for encryption backdoors as a solution, when it seems increasingly clear now that the plotters there were communicating either in person or on Facebook or via other unencrypted channels like ordinary text messaging. Encryption becomes a kind of scapegoat for the failure of intelligence services, whether or not it had anything to do with why an attack wasn't detected. But what's important to recognize here is that if you actually look at the encryption tools that are advocated for use by organizations like ISIS, it's not tools that any kind of U.S. mandate is going to affect. The most popular encrypted communications software out there is not stuff that's made by U.S. corporations you can serve with an order to give the government a back door. You, at the end of the day, there just isn't in practice a way to stop bad people from using encryption. There's only a way to make it more inconvenient and insecure for law-abiding people to use encryption.
Julian Sanchez, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Julian Sanchez, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we talked about how the internet of today and of the future is not the boundless, unregulated sea of free ideas and speech that we once envisioned. Instead, it's largely become a marketplace where the rules and the borders are shaped by corporations who operate in their own interest. Here's Scott Malcolmson, author of SplinterNet, How Geopolitics and Commerce Are Fragmenting the World Wide Web. He was on the show yesterday.
I think it's shaped more like Google and Apple and not so much like the U.S. Constitution.
Apple and Google and other companies, too, deciding the shape of the internet. And at the same time, governments who want to control or watch the flow of information. Here's Scott Malcolmson again.
What happens next is political rather than technical. What happens next is that people organize in order to try and defend or take back a right of expression over the internet.
So-called digital dissenters are part of what Scott Malcolmson is talking about there, a growing group of activists and thinkers who want users to take back control of cyberspace from corporations, from marketers, and from surveillance. One of those digital dissenters joins me now. Astra Taylor is a documentary filmmaker and author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra Taylor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you and your cohorts, I guess, have been called dissenters or humanists or team human, even Luddites by some people. Describe this movement and its main objections to the shape of today's internet.
Yeah, I think even if you go back 5 or 6 years, a lot of the discussions about the internet were very triumphalist. Social media was going to bring down the old media model and usher in a democratized media era where the sort of everyday person could triumph over established interests. And it's interesting because in the last few years, the conversation's gotten a bit more doubtful, right? There have been revelations from Snowden about government surveillance, and there have been revelations about labor abuses from companies like Apple, or even the discussion that's going on about the way platforms like Uber treat their workers. There's been kind of examples of Facebook's emotional contagion experiment, all of these things that have kind of disillusioned people. I think what the cohort I'm part of, or at least the purpose of my book, The People's Platform, was really to say it actually, we don't have to get mired in disappointment. You know, there could be another way. And in fact, The People's Platform as a title, I was drawn to it because it's kind of sardonic on the one hand, but it's also aspirational. The internet isn't a people's platform. It's corporatized all the way down. In fact, there's no such thing as a public internet, but it could be. So in that sense, I'm definitely not anti-technological. And the Luddites are mistaken as being anti-tech, right? They were these textile workers who broke the looms in the early 19th century. And so you can kind of see them as these people who were, you know, on Team Flintstone as opposed to Team Jetson or something. They hated the future. They hated technology. But actually, they were protesting their exploitation and the fact that, you know, machines were being used to drive down their wages and make their lives more difficult. So I think in that sense, perhaps I am a Luddite, if you look at it not as being anti-tech, but really being anti-inequality and anti-exploitation.
So then taking back the internet and the free expression and the free movement and non-corporatization that you think it was meant to be, or at least envisioned to be when it was first strung together, when those computers were strung together, how does that happen? What do you envision people doing to get out from under Apple and Google and Snapchat and Facebook?
Yeah, people have to organize. And this is the thing. One thing I try to emphasize is that, you know, we've sort of been here before. When we talk about the internet, it's like change and revolution and disruption. And we really emphasize the novelty. You know, how amazing is it that we can leave comments for our friends when we used to only have a few channels or a few hundred channels to choose from? Or, you know, back in the day when it was only the radio or the television to entertain you. And it's true, the internet and associated technologies do have a really remarkable infrastructure. You know, the fact that it can be many to many. It's remarkable. We all love the internet. But at the same time, there's a lot of continuity with the past system. A lot of the problems of the old media model have carried over. And I'm thinking about centralization, consolidation, and commercialism mainly. You know, the fact that, yeah, sure, we have these personalized devices, but they're all connected to a sort of very centralized, opaque backend that few of us understand. The fact that there's been a return of monopolies and also a vertical integration. So you can see a company like Amazon that doesn't just sell books, but it's the bookstore and it offers web hosting services, right? And commercialism, the fact that we have this remarkable new technology and yet it's funded through this retrograde model of advertising. It's like we've gone back to the past, to the old days of, our news being sponsored by Camel cigarettes and stuff. We all see the return of branded content and you know, advertising dollars fund this whole thing, just like didn't, you know, the television era.
And I wanted to ask you about that because people complain, of course, about when you use Facebook because it's free. That means you're the product, your information, your likes and dislikes. None of that is new. We've seen this before. We've been the product on television for decades. Free ads targeted to the audience the content is designed to attract.
Exactly. So in a sense, I'm saying the disruption didn't go deep enough. You know, I want more disruption. I want us to disrupt those underlying business models because that's the problem, the economic system our technologies are embedded in, not the technology itself. And the fact that the old business models have essentially carried over and, in fact, they've metastasized, right? So now advertising is even more of the funding source for more of the things we're doing, you know, not just for the television shows, but for our basic communications and for our places that we organize as citizens and you know, where we're supposed to learn. We talk about Google as a library, but really that's quite misleading because it's not a library. It's not publicly funded the way a library is, and it doesn't exist for, you know, to maintain an archive of knowledge. It's an advertising company. So my point is that with the, you know, what to do is to look back to the past to some of the old solutions that people embraced, which was to push back on advertisers, to use, you know, antitrust to break up monopolies, to institute baseline privacy laws, to open up spaces of non-commercial media. So I think the toolkit for today is actually the toolkit we used in the past. We just need to update it for a digital age.
What about individuals? Let's get practical for 1 second. Things like in private browsing, disabling cookies, the types of things that advertisers and corporations use to track your likes and dislikes so that they know how to advertise to you. Is it worth disabling those things?
I think it is worth disabling those things, though there is a paradox, because right now, if we don't pay for things directly, then, you know, the problem is that we've handed over the funding of culture online to advertisers. So, you know, we in a way have to either pay with our personal data or we have to pay with money if we want to see certain things exist in the world. So I think, you know, there is the power of the purse for people. You know, I, for example, pay for my internet service. I don't use Gmail because I don't want to be ultimately paying with my information and having my emails be used to target ads to me. I guess I'm a bit wary of privacy being something that only the well-off can afford, privacy becoming a kind of luxury good. And I'm slightly wary of the idea that we can chop our way into a better world. That's why I really do think we actually need to band together as citizens and demand some structural changes, like baseline privacy law that would affect everybody instead of those of us who have the wherewithal, you know, protecting ourselves one by one online.
Pushing back against a corporate-based, advertising-based, tracking-based internet. Astra Taylor is a documentary filmmaker and author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra Taylor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
The Studio Museum in Harlem has a nearly 50-year history celebrating and fostering Black artists. If you're visiting New York or if you live in the city, today you'll find a museum with a much higher profile than it had in 1968. The Studio Museum has 110,000 visitors a year now, up 27% since Thelma Golden assumed the director's chair 10 years ago. The studio's mission has expanded as well beyond just African-American art to artists of African descent from all over the world. As part of our series of end-of-year conversations here on The Takeaway, I sat down with Thelma Golden. She says the Studio Museum plays many roles today, including as a space for dialogue.
When I think about museums, I think they can play many different roles. But being the steward of a museum devoted to artists of African descent, it seems important that the museum be involved not simply in presenting or preserving, but opening up a space of dialogue, a dialogue about art, about culture, about humanity. And so in that way, the institution becomes a think tank, a place where audiences and artists can engage in the important questions of our day.
Well, that's important because you've talked also about this idea of making art not just content, not just something that goes up on a website or is commercially available, although it can be that, but more as a way to engage people, this conversation that you're talking about. How have you approached making your museum much more than content, much more than a field trip, frankly, for, let's say, tourists listening to this who decide to go up to Harlem to visit the museum. Make it more than that and make it the type of experience and the type of engagement that you're talking about.
Well, at the Studio Museum, we hope to create an amazing experience for people who visit, because what we think can happen in the engagement with artists is the opening of many, many ways of seeing the world through the eyes of artists. Many of our programs are the work of living artists. Our current exhibitions on view now show a range of artists who are thinking about art and thinking about themselves, thinking about identity, culture, and history in new and different ways. And that experience allows people to not only enjoy the artwork on the walls, but to really think seriously when they leave the museum of how they see the world.
21 years ago, you were the curator of a now famous, to some people infamous, I suppose, exhibit at the Whitney Museum here in New York called Black Male. I mean, it got some good reviews, some bad reviews, certainly a lot of talk and controversy that seemed to be an important beginning of a conversation about images, perceptions, portrayals of black males. Where has that conversation landed now? I'm not suggesting that it's over, but it's been 20 years.
Mm-hmm. That conversation continues with artists. And it continues with many thinkers and public intellectuals who are understanding that in our world, this image of the black male is one that still is a way for us to understand our history and our current circumstance in all of the profound and powerful ways that we are living in the world now. That exhibition made 20 years ago, to me, in some ways feels like a long time ago, but in many ways, I could have made that exhibition today.
Mm-hmm. Would it be the same today, much different?
It wouldn't be the same, but it would probably have the same texture. It would include different artists, of course, because generationally there's a wide group of artists that have continued this exploration. So it would feel the same, but probably be broader, expanded, deeper in many ways.
Talk about the tension, and I don't know if it's tension or controversy. There's certainly a conversation that goes on in the art world about the importance of having a space and a place to promote black artists and black art versus promoting black artists and black art out in the art world. And part of the problem that some people see is it's great to have a studio museum, but why are black artists in a house of black art instead of being promoted out to the general public? And that conversation goes on. What's your take on that?
We need both. A museum like the Studio Museum was founded to correct the exclusions of black artists from the canon of art history. And when it was formed in the late 60s, and through the work of many curators and directors before me, it really did change the way the art world understands black artists. But we also want to see a broad presentation of these artists in museums around the city and around the world.
And you've also talked about this art, both in your museum and more broadly, as going for a spirit of post-black. What does that mean?
In 2001, I made an exhibition at the Studio Museum in Harlem called Freestyle. And in that exhibition, which presented the work of 28 emerging artists, what I wanted to position was a way in which to understand a generation of black artists coming of age in that moment who saw themselves deeply through their identity and race, but understood themselves in broader ways in the art world. It was a way to reform the way in which we had understood black artists' work in the moments post the black arts movement. It was a way to create a new sense of a way to think about art and think about artists, and also for at the Studio Museum for us to begin and continue to write new art histories.
Now, you've been appointed to President Obama's board for his foundation. You're going to have a role in the Obama Library. Is that correct?
It is.
How do you view your role there, especially from the perspective of black art and the position that a presidential library, they can be so separate and kind of mm-hmm. didactic. Is there a move afoot to make that more community-oriented? I'm not sure what you all have planned.
The presidential library is in the planning phase, and I'm really proud to be on the board. And there are many ideas and an incredible group of people thinking about the exciting, amazing opportunity that this important institution will create.
Now, let's talk about architecture for a second, because your building, you have a brand new building happening in Harlem, right? A big budget project.
We have just announced an expansion, which will create for us a new custom-built museum on our current site. Our current building is a 1914 building that was built to be a bank and an office building. And when the museum moved into it in 1981, in an amazingly sensitive redesign by the late architect Max Bonn, it was an incredible example of adaptive reuse, a bank made into a museum. And we have loved working in that space, having artists really imagine their work in these rooms that have been our museum for many years. But what we are doing now with the architect David Adjaye and Adjaye Associates, in cooperation with the architects Coopers Robertson, is envisioning an incredible building which will serve our artists' collections and our audiences in amazing ways.
The Studio Museum in Harlem, the work of director and chief curator Thelma Golden. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. It's pretty easy to understand why Milan and Rome would want to restrict the use of motorized vehicles to cut air pollution. They made that announcement on Monday. But another town in Italy is taking things a step further. The mayor of San Vitaliano has banned the use of wood-fired ovens in restaurants for the next 3 months. Cleaner air, less delicious pizza when you're Italian. Life is full of trade-offs. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding cancer research across the continuum, from basic research through clinical trials to advanced therapies that save thousands of lives. More information is available at lls.org.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.